Good morning. It's currently 7 degrees in Toronto. This is the 10 o'clock update from the CIUT-FM newsroom. I'm Mark Greenberg. Israeli authorities have imposed an unprecedented security clampdown on the occupied territories in an attempt to curb widespread violence expected tomorrow when Palestinians observe their Land Day. The army declared both the West Bank and Gaza Strip closed off military areas for 3 days and barred journalists from entering the areas except under military escort. Explaining the measures, Defense Minister Yitzhak Rabin said they were necessary to prevent the outbreak of serious disorders tomorrow. Land Day commemorates the killing of 6 Israeli Arabs by soldiers in 1976 during demonstrations in Galilee against government expropriation of Arab lands. Thousands of Armenians in a disputed region of the Caucasus stayed away from factories and schools yesterday, protesting the Kremlin's refusal to make the area part of the Armenian Republic. The government newspaper Izvestia reported that groups of young men, pedestrians, and busloads of workers from reporting to their jobs in Stepanakert, the main city of the Nagorno-Karabakh region. It reported authorities used loudspeakers and leaflets to urge an end to the strike. Prime Minister Brian Mulroney blasted the United States yesterday for its inaction on acid rain and vowed to renew his uphill campaign for U.S. controls when he meets President Ronald Reagan next month. While Mr. Mulroney's criticism broke no new ground, his sharp tone indicated that despite entrenched Reagan administration opposition to acid rain controls, he will continue to press Canada's case. Mr. Mulroney's comments on acid rain were made in a rising voice, which grew louder with each sentence and received a round of applause. He stated that it is not only in the interest of Canadians, but all Americans and Canadians, and it must be solved now. South African commandos struck across the Botswana border early yesterday, killing 4 people they said were African National Congress fighters. The attack was condemned in a statement from the offices of Botswana President Kwet Masire that accused South Africa of murdering innocent people. Although it was the first incursion that Pretoria has officially admitted since a raid into Zambia last April, the attack came less than a week after an ANC fighter was slain by unknown gunmen in a hospital bed in Maseru. Pretoria is suspected of being behind that killing, as well as recent bombing incidents and raids into neighboring Swaziland, Zimbabwe, Botswana, and Mozambique. The Royal Bank of Canada has conceded that some service charge increases have caught consumers by surprise and has undertaken to publish an annual fee schedule each fall. The bank will also reduce or eliminate the fees that customers have singled out as irritants. And Metro Toronto has trimmed its shortlist of new dumps for its worsening garbage problem to 2 candidates, probably in Scarborough and the region of Durham. Works Commissioner Frank Horgan warned that further soil, water, and environmental impact studies at the sites, whose exact locations remain a closely guarded secret, could cost taxpayers as much as $600,000. Mr. Horgan indicated that he expects heated debate over the sociological impact of the consultants' recommendations, which are to be made public at a meeting of Metro Council's Works Committee today. but Councillor Richard Gilbert, who is expected to present his study to the Works Committee, entitled The Solid Waste Crisis and Some Solutions, said that Metro's garbage problem is too serious to cave in to provincial government inaction. This has been a news update. The next complete news sports can be heard at 11 o'clock. For CIUT-FM News, I'm Mark Greenberg.
morning, and once again, it's that time of Tuesday morning, 10:10, and this is One Step Beyond on CIUT. My name is Tim Haffey. We have we're going to take a rather radical twist in our programming today. We're going to do it live. Bob Marshall will be joining me later. Bob is an aficionado of the genre, which is what One Step Beyond is all about, conspiracy theories and that sort of thing, and looking at politics from an alternative point of view, the events that shape our times, that sort of thing, from a rather different perspective. Anyway, before we go to Bob, Bob talked to Dr. Beter, who has been featured on this program at least four or five times. And, of course, Dr. Beter has provoked all sorts of interesting reactions from from the listeners. Some rather skeptical, some begging for more, and others just really not knowing what to say. Anyway, Bob spoke to Dr. Beter a couple of years ago. Bob used to host a similar type radio show a couple of years ago on another station, and had Dr. Beter on the line. Of course, he died about a year ago. And we'll play, just run a bit of that interview for you, maybe 5-10 minutes or so before we go to Bob live. Anyway, here's Bob Marshall speaking with Dr. Beter roughly 2 years ago.
And I'm sure my listeners have a lot of questions. I think we need a little background on your career and how you first got into government work in the Kennedy administration.
Well, hello, Bob. How are you?
All right.
Things down here in Washington are still the same as when I was appointed by President Kennedy to the Export-Import Bank. Nothing has changed. Maybe it's gotten a little worse, but, these things go in waves.
What kind of service had you done to draw Mr. Kennedy's attention?
Well, you know, I was a resident, really, of West Virginia, and I helped him and Bobby in their campaign down there in the primary, and they remembered that.
All right. Now, had you done any kind of intelligence work up to that point?
No, none whatsoever. It was only... I did represent some people in the company as a legal person here for them on their private affairs, and that was about it.
Well, did you have contacts with military people? I recall in one of your tapes you knew some colonel during the war, I think.
Oh, yes. That was intelligence work in Detroit.
Yes, but you weren't really employed in intelligence. You just knew these people.
No, I was in intelligence during the war.
Can you say why you got into intelligence during the war? Were you just lucky, or did you have a background that the attention was drawn to you to employ you there?
No, I had no background in intelligence. It seemed that Colonel O'Neill liked my work, and he offered me a job in another section. And I stayed there for about 3 years with the Army Air Corps.
And then that was until the end of the war?
That's right.
And then you pursued law?
I was studying for law at that time, you see. And then when I graduated from law in 1951 here in Washington, George Washington University, I began to practice down in Southwest Washington, which is about 90% black. I took the Constitution down to the waterfront. And I did a lot of public service work for black people. But also down there, I found a lot of rich people. And I had gotten the fees from them and did a lot of free work for the blacks.
So you would you class yourself as a liberal?
No, I'm not a liberal. I'm liberal in social work, yes, but a conservative in economic affairs.
I see, but you had a basic sympathy for the poor of of that period.
Oh, yes, because, you know, we go through these stages, and it's very important to go through them in order to provide a very good basis for your life.
Yes. Now, while working for Kennedy, what did you see something in your government work that prompted you to run for governor of West Virginia in 1968?
Well, the people down in West Virginia came to me and asked me to run. And, of course, I did consider it, but I wasn't very active in promoting it. But after a while, I did consent to go to West Virginia, and my wife and I grassrooted the state of West Virginia for 1 year. But halfway through the year, Bob, I found out that the political machine that ran West Virginia on behalf of the, non-resident corporations, mostly in New York, had run the state into the ground. It was full of corruption. talk about corruption in so-called other countries, third world countries, you don't know what corruption is until you go to my state of West Virginia at that time.
Yes.
So halfway through the campaign, Bob, I switched horses and ran as an independent Republican. And this was never done before in the state of Democratic politics. However, I did do that, and 2 weeks before the election, I got a call from the machine, the political, saying that if I didn't pay them $250,000, my votes would not be counted. And this was quite a shock to me. But they had been telling me that politics was a business. And there's one way they made a living. And I refused to pay $250,000. To have my votes counted by the machines. Because in those counties where they did have voting, I didn't get one vote. However, in the rural areas where they did count it by ballot, I did get a good substantial vote. I was ahead at the time, but when I refused to pay the $250,000bribe money, well, I knew the election was over. Yeah. Of course, this was confirmed to me 2 weeks later by a man who did admit that the voting machines were fixed. And today, all over the United States, in very key precincts, Bob, voting machines are robbing the American people of their franchise to vote.
Yes, and you said that's why President Reagan was able to make his political comeback and become president in 1980.
Yes, to a large extent, that's true, but he doesn't know about it.
Yes. Now, back in 1968, when you discovered this corruption, how would you attribute your, we'll say, naivety at that point, considering you'd worked in government? How come you did not become aware of that while working for the Kennedys?
Well, because I was, let's say, naive. I was very much of a liberal. I had put my faith in man to do good. My slogan for West Virginia was to do good and be good for West Virginia. And I never realized that politics was this way. The voting for Kennedy down in West Virginia, as far as I knew, because headed up the professional segment of the society, that is lawyers, doctors, for Kennedy. So I was rather removed from any idea of a voting machine or anything like that.
So it's very secret, this kind of knowledge about what goes on and how these, networks, political corporate networks, run these machines, so that even one in working government would not see this.
No, they don't see it. There are quite a number of lawsuits all over the country now, as exposed by the New York Times in recent months. There's been quite a number of lawsuits in fraudulent elections due to these voting machines. When I confronted one of the men who did fix the machines, I asked him, why did he do it? And he says, well, Mr. Beter, I need the money. And he told me how it was done, and that he goes to a place where they teach him how to ostensibly correct and repair these voting machines. But in effect, they tell them how to fix them, persons who they want. And so in our national elections, from my own sources, they have picked out key precincts to use this thing. It's very dangerous. Now England is thinking about using machines, and I've warned them, certain people, that don't ever use these voting machines because they can be fixed.
Okay, now, you then left the United States to work in the Congo. Was that out of disillusionment or just private business interests?
Well, that was private business interests because President Mobutu and General Musiala, immediately after they got their independence, had got a promise out of me that if I lost the election for governorship in West Virginia, if I would come and help them develop that country. And they reminded me of that promise when I lost. And so I went there and I worked in the Congo for 5 years helping to develop that country by bringing in international companies, multinational companies, to give those people work. The black people in the Congo and all over Africa, what they want foremost of all is work. And I think I succeeded in 5 years. And then I came back here and wrote that book, The Conspiracy Against the Dollar.
Yeah, now, did you learn something during that five-year tenure in Africa that prompted you to write the book, or were you working on that anyways before you went?
No, Bob, I wasn't working on it. That book came out of intelligence sources of the British, because I had done one or things for the British government. They wanted to reciprocate, and they told me all about the gold being fleeced from Fort Knox. And they told me about certain things going on, and I never thought about writing a book. It's just that my work was over, a five-year contract was over in the Congo, and everything was going well, and so I needed a rest. And when I got back to Cape Cod, where my wife was, then I began to write the book.
Yes, and you started to write that in 73, and Watergate started to surface in the in that period.
All right, that was Bob Marshall speaking to Dr. Beter, 86. And, of course, Dr. Beter is known to regular listeners of this show as the author of the audio letters. And, of course, Dr. Beter has been on One Step Beyond here on CIU four times. And Bob Marshall joins me now. Bob, Dr. Beter has certainly provoked a wide range of reactions from the listeners to this show. And to tell you the truth, it's not hardly surprising. Dr. Beter, among other things, well, I guess what stands out is the last three Dr. Beter tapes we aired dealing with the what he called the secret military mission of the Space Shuttle Columbia. Now, we've heard a little bit of Doc background here. However, what he was talking about, the secret military mission of the Space Shuttle Columbia, we got into space shuttles being blown up, astronauts coming back as genetic replicas. It sounds like sci-fi. Very hard. The natural instinct is to be skeptical. Bob, how credible is this stuff? And Where roughly does he get this information from?
Well, it's not credible if you consider how we're educated in the mass media and in our own school system. But Dr. Beter was often stressed the fact that the real developments in technology are 30 years behind what the popular awareness is. But even if one doesn't believe it, don't you think it would be interesting to hear the implications of such technology? Now, the Robotoids, the Star Wars and that stuff, he sat on that since 1977. He didn't really start to talk about it until 1979. But events since then certainly indicate the possibility of Star Wars and secret battles in space, if not in the future, then they may have happened already. If they are going to be happening in the future, what are the implications for national governments? So these things, could be regarded as an audio form, an acoustic form of science fiction. But personally, the reason I thought we'd start off with this interview is that I was fortunate enough to meet Dr. Beter and meet some of his associates a few months before he died in some private matters. And I found out that people on very high levels use his tapes, and he did create 80 of them over, say, 7 years, used his tapes as a guideline in their business matters and in government matters. But they would never admit it in a public forum. So where does that leave us? Why not listen to it every now and then? I think we feature Dave Emery and Nip Tuck, who are well documented in their information. And their information leads you to sort of erase a few assumptions and look at news and world events afresh. And in the gap between what they present and what could be, Dr. Beter offers a borderline.
Can you refer to Dr. Beter's materials almost, you can take it as acoustic science fiction. However, the way he presents it as
fact,
so to speak, as this is the information he has dug up, and he is presenting it to us for our information type thing, or for our education,
yeah,
or whatever, almost as a news item. Now, we have, on One Step Beyond, we've, as you mentioned, had we've played Dave Emery and Nip Tuck. We covered the entire Robert F. Kennedy assassination series. And we're now into the Iran-Contra, their latest series on the Iran-Contra scandal. And the key difference I noticed between the two two tapes is that Dave Emery and Nip Tuck, as you mentioned, go to painstaking lengths to back up and cite all their sources and present it in this very plotting type manner. I don't necessarily not commenting on the delivery so much, but just the way in which it's presented. Each little segment sort of builds on the other type thing. Well, however, Dr. Beter, for one reason or another, does not cite his sources. Now, why is that? Is it because they're just too secret to reveal, or...
Because those sources were involved in the highest levels of intelligence, and they did have a problem where one of the names of the sources got out, and that person was killed. And that weighs heavy on his conscience, so they made an extreme provision not to ever talk about the sources. And... You know, I mean, the major media had blacklisted Dr. Beter. He offered to present his information to congressional committees. He offered to do it for the Fort Knox gold scandal. He never was allowed to, but he was fully prepared. I've seen much of his papers and correspondence with senators and congressmen. I mean, this man was a top international lawyer. And why would he put his reputation on the line? So he felt that his material, his files, backed him up, and he was going to present them in court or in a committee hearing, in a congressional committee hearing. But up to that point, he had to protect his sources. And so why should he tell you, or any of us, his sources, if it's real and it's going to kill somebody? Because basically he was trying to communicate. The tapes that I got were for... citizens and senators. They weren't really for the major media. They were for people in intelligence and other parts of intelligence who could use that information. In other words, the tapes represent a secret battle that was going on, which he warned about and talked about for those 7 years. They could be gotten by anybody because he had a Democratic kind of personality, but he was basically keying and fighting within the secret government.
Yeah, obviously we're not going to get into names here, but some of the scenarios that Dr. Beter has presented are, to say the least, they're shocking.
Yes.
Shocking in the extreme, such as NASA and the U.S. government, the implications of covering up space shuttle disasters we've never heard of and that sort of thing. We've already discussed this to a certain extent, but how exactly does he get the information? Are people to him, or does he just have a network of people he draws on and...
He used to meet. He lived in the 70s in Cape Cod. He had made he was quite wealthy from his law work in the 50s and 60s, and I guess in the Congo he got paid well. So he came back and wrote the book Conspiracy Against the Dollar. And from 75 till early 80s, he lived in Cape Cod. And his wife told me that these men would fly in every month, and he'd do the tape every month, and they had their little recording set up at his place in Cape Cod, and. He told me when he stopped doing the tapes in 82 because they threatened to kill his family. He'd already had a few heart attacks before that, which I don't think he felt were of natural causes. But when they threatened to kill his children, then he had to stop. And he told me that his sources came and took all his files away within a year. I mean, even now.
And what motivated the sources to come to him? What did they get out of this?
Well, the reason we played that part of the interview is the man was of service to people in the company, as they call it. He personally was a friend of theirs. He helped them in their private matters for legal situations. And living in Washington all those years and working around Georgetown University, which is where a lot of the intelligence ideology and strategy is planned, or people are trained in that part of Washington, it was just part of his milieu. But he never... For example, one of his tapes he talks about, he was asked by a CIA person to check something out in Lebanon in 1958, but he was not an official government, worker in intelligence matters. He just knew these people, and they knew from his legal reputation that he would be an interesting person to give this information to so he could attract some public attention.
He started making these tapes in the early 1980s, correct?
In 70. See, He was on the radio in 71, 72, 73 during the Watergate stuff, especially in, I think it's Long John Neville show in New York. But then that was stopped around 73, 74. And then he was talking about the fact there was no gold in Fort Knox. I should correct that. 71, 72, he was still in Zaire. So he started getting on the talk shows in 73 when he came back as a result of his book, Conspiracy Against the Dollar.
When did the audio letter start?
In 75. But that was from 73 to 75. He tried to get Congress to investigate the fact there was no gold at Fort Knox. And when that was covered up in September 74, he started making his tapes. And he called them audio first phase from June 75. And they went till November 1982. And he made many predictions in those that came true. For example, he predicted the assassination of Sadat a week before it happened. He predicted the rise of Gorbachev years before anybody else did. And he he predicted where the, on the science fiction level, he predicted where the Skylab would collapse, what part of the planet it would land in, which was near the Indian Ocean and over Australia. So he has a good record in some things, but as for proving there are robotoids, that would that hasn't...
Well, okay, the question of robotoids, I believe you refer to them as genetic replicas. I guess we're talking about the same thing.
Yeah.
In the
well, they're computer. They're not clones. He said they were like computerized animals. They were organic robotoids.
I guess it's the genetic replica thing came into, I believe, the on the tapes we're playing in the secret military mission of the space shuttle Columbia. Now, the astronauts, maybe you could just run down the scenario, what exactly happened, and how, according to Dr. Beter, the genetic replica technology was applied as part of this, whatever you want to call it, this charade performed before the American public regarding this space shuttle.
Well, he talked and he said none of the challenges, none of those space shuttles from April 81 through the next few years was a successful flight, if I recall. Well, he monitored only up till November 82. Who would have believed they were getting blown up? But then in January 1986, it happened right in front of us. And there's lots of documentation from more normal sources like Mae Brussels that show there is some conspiratorial problem around the space shuttle. Now, that could be just disinformation in the media and confusion. What if there was a secret battle going on and some group knocked off the space shuttle? But back in April 81, they went up, Crippen and Young, I think their names were. They were blown up outside of our atmosphere. There was a big flash scene over New Orleans in that area.
Okay, we'll put this in context. What we're doing is quoting Dr. Beter. This is straight out of Dr. Beter's tapes. That is the source, and we're merely discussing what he has presented in past shows on here on One Step Beyond.
Leading up to the organic robotoids. So so they had to have a ship come in, a space shuttle come in, and land for public consumption on TV. So they had another space shuttle flown in, and they landed in California. I can't remember the Air Force Base, Andrews Air Force Base, I guess. And if you remember that first landing, this was a historical moment, the first time the space shuttle, as an achievement in re-entry. They had a 45-minute delay in the astronauts coming out or the pilots coming out and being presented to Dan Rather and the various major networks. Now, Beter said that that 45-minute delay was the organizing time to allow these organic robotoids to be conditioned or to present Crippen and Young. Now, we can simply go to Crippen and Young now and check them out. I welcome anybody to call them up, interview them, and see if they can prove they're not robotoids.
Well, that's an interesting point. How do these genetic replicas, if they do in fact exist, how do they continue to function in Crippen and Young? I guess we're talking, I don't know, 5-6 years later.
Yeah. No, 2 years. Yeah, you're right, 5 years later. Well, take Jimmy Carter. According to Dr. Beter, Jimmy Carter was killed in 1979, Amy was killed, and the whole family, all right?
All right, wait.
No.
This is according to Dr. Beter.
Yeah, according to Dr. Beter.
Continue.
Yeah, and, I mean, this is a responsible citizen. Why is he making these claims? Well, if you follow Jimmy Carter's career, he's out of the public eye for ever since he lost the election. Now, Amy was in the CIA trial, wasn't it, for protests last year with Abby Hoffman, and she may be real. So, but of course, we could accuse Dr. Beter of being irresponsible, but why would he do that to risk what he was warning on other levels?
How credible...
should he bother bringing it up?
If this genetic replica technology does in fact exist and it is in fact being used... who is doing this? Who is making these decisions to supposedly eliminate people and replace them with these robotoids?
Well, high oligarchical powers have been very powerful and are multinational for years. He actually named the Rockefellers, and he named the Bolshevik power structure in Russia. Now, as a result of the Battle of Harvest Moon, the Rockefellers were killed off. The Bolsheviks took over the Pentagon, and Caspar Weinberger, he claimed, represented that part of the Pentagon. Now, there's some interesting things. I asked him just before he died, what was the meaning of Iran-Contragate? And he said, well, that's all political. That's for the election. And I said, does it mean that the Rockefeller group, that grouping, not just the family, but the people around them, are making a comeback against the Bolshevik control of the Pentagon? He says, yes, that's what's happening. And As a result, you had Weinberger resign, what was earlier, a few months ago, right? Now, that would represent a major, on a public level, power shift. But, you know, I personally do not know if this is true. But as we learn more and more through the 80s about the machinations behind the scenes, might not have Dr. Beter as a wall to bounce her head off, you know? Because, again, it gets boring for people to hear it documented like Dave Emery and Mae Brussels. Either they have their role, but what are the larger implications? We are going to have to deal with some kind of clones or robotoids, and what if the government leaders are being replaced on a daily basis within 50 years? Well, this will change politics.
I guess, as they say, truth is stranger than fiction. We are by no means espousing opinions as truth here on this show. We're merely discussing what Dr. Beter has, in fact, presented and trying to put it in some sort of context. Anyway, Dr. Beter is one spokesman for, I guess, what we could call, a conspiracy genre, which includes, as you mentioned, Mae Brussels and Dave Emery and Nip Tuck. How accurate am I in calling it a conspiracy genre? What would you call this entire, this entire subject matter that these people present and deal with and research?
Well, Iran-Contra has popularized the term the secret team. Mm-hmm. And I think the way we're presenting information in schools, in public schools and university, it's fragmented, it's categories, it deals with nations and that. But for multinational corporations, the planet is very tiny. And I think that they have to deal with their international obligations and mix in with the national bureaucracies. So you have to have in the foreign departments, the foreign affairs bureaucracies, these secret agreements. And the relationship between them and the national governments is a whole area of reality that we are not—that's not talked about in the media. So I would say that Mae Brussels and Emery and the Executive Intelligence Review and Tom Davis's book sources offer the massive amounts of literature by journalists and all kinds of writers about the machinations this multinational interface creates.
All right, we've created a little one step beyond starters kit here. Maybe you can go into that.
Well, Mae Brussels stopped making tapes, but she did an extraordinary amount of work for the last 10 years, and you can send in $3 and we'll give you a list of how to get the index to Mae's collection of 10 years of tapes, weekly tapes, 52 tapes a year. Also, Dave Emery, Nip Tuck, we feature, have backed up Mae's research with particular detailed tapes on various topics that Mae Brussels first made the inroads into. And then Tom Davis, who is Dave Emery, Nip Tuck's, and Mae Brussels' main and best source of books, offers an incredible index that we will Xerox for you, well-categorized, well-inventoried, of the whole range, 500 or more books that are available.
There's got to be 80 to 100 titles on the John F. Kennedy assassination alone in there. And I guess we should mention a lot of these titles are from all sorts of different sources. Some are mainstream-type books you can pick up in Kohl's, such as this one here, Reasonably Heard. I've seen that in the bookstores many times. And other less, more obscure documents, unpublished stuff.
You could say it goes from right to left. There's the normal right-wing kind of books, then there's a more obscure right-wing leading into the fascist cells, and then there's the left-wing normal literature, then the far left, and then there's mainstream, then there's independent political affiliation. So it's the most comprehensive access and a way of quickly getting access to this information if our listeners are interested. Also, we feature the one source. We'll give you the list of the one source to get Dr. Beter's tapes, and it features sort of an inventory of the main highlights of the best Dr. Beter tapes.
So what we're talking about here is, I'd say, at least 20 Xerox sheets. So the $3 simply covers posting, handling, and photocopying charges.
Yes.
Anyway, if you're interested in the, I guess we'll call it the One Step Beyond Starter Kit with all the information and catalogs and whatnot you need to access these tapes or learn more about them, simply send your check for $3, payable to CIUT-FM, care of 91 St. George Street, Toronto, Ontario. The postal code is M5S, that's M5S2E8. And the envelope address it, care of One Step Beyond, CIUT 89, or One Step Beyond, University of Toronto Community Radio, Inc., 91 St. George Street, Toronto, Ontario, M5S2E8. And send a little letter if you want. Anyway, $3 is the charge, and that'll get you a One Step Beyond Starters kit, and we should have it out to you as quickly as possible as soon as upon receipt of the check. Anyway, I've been speaking to Bob Marshall, Thank you for joining us today, Bob.
Well, I just wanted to end off saying I have nothing to do with this show, Tim. Remember, I work at another radio station, so please address all inquiries to Tim. He can check with me. But
actually, I just went over that. We're addressing the inquiries to One Step Beyond. CIUC, yeah. Care of One Step Beyond. Anyway, thank you for joining us, Bob. Bob, our special guest today on One Step Beyond. Bob, an aficionado, I guess, or a connoisseur, whatever you want to...
A dupe of this information.
Right, a student of this conspiracy genre, which we feature here on One Step Beyond every Tuesday between 10:10 and 10:40. And once again, I'd like to stress the opinions expressed here on One Step Beyond do not necessarily reflect those of CIUT or its staff. They are those of the speaker. And on that note, we'll wind it up.
Thank you, Tim.
See you next week. Appointments to keep, deadlines to meet, shoulder drivers tear past cars in a traffic jam. Equally as dangerous is the weaver who cuts in and out of traffic, usually without signaling. Both are dangerous to save time at the expense of safety. Law-abiding and courteous drivers are safe drivers who take those few extra seconds to increase the margin of safety. For the Ontario Ministry of Transportation, I'm Bob McIntosh, reminding you, every driver should be courteous. Courtesy is catching. Pass it on.
Can you get AIDS by working with someone who has AIDS? No. Nor can you get AIDS from talking to a person who has AIDS. AIDS is transmitted during sexual intercourse with someone who has been infected. If you have any questions, call this free number for the facts about AIDS. 1-800-668-2437. Let's talk.
This is the Africa Journal. I'm Richard Verrier. On this week's show, we have an interview with York University professor John Soule on the current situation in South Africa.